Hello. Welcome to Building Software as a Service Solutions on Windows Azure. For those of you who didn't go through the trouble to figure out the QR code, you would be rewarded if you decoded it with the string, QR codes are stupid. That's all it says. It's not worth the trouble. Let me get the zoom back. I had to zoom in to get this. There we go. So, building software as a service solutions on Windows Azure, that's what we're going to talk about. My name is Steve Marks. That's a little self-portrait I drew. I think it looks just like me. You can remember me as Smarks. If you don't already know or follow me online, my website is smarks.com. My Twitter handle is Smarks. On GitHub, I'm Smarks. My email address is smarks@smarks.com. So, just remember Smarks and you'll be able to find me pretty easily. So let me tell you a little bit about who I am, and then we'll get into we'll talk about what this session is going to be. So probably most important to this talk is that I am a former member of the Windows Azure team. So I was there. I joined the team in 2007. We had our first CTP, our preview release was in 2008. So I got there sort of in the year leading up to that, where a lot of the core technology was working, but we were just trying to figure out how to expose the functionality to developers and build an SDK and sort of turn the product into something that you all could use. So I've been on the Windows Azure team for quite some time. Mostly the time that I was on that team, I did a little bit of work on that sort of early SDK, but mostly I've been doing talks, writing blog posts, sort of quasi-evangelizing the platform, just explaining to people how to kind of make good use of it. I'm no longer there. I left in February. I left Microsoft and thus the Windows Azure team. And I am now doing two different jobs, one of which is I'm the chief cloud architect for a company called Aditi Technologies. We're an SI. And so basically I'm doing consulting around Windows Azure now as one of my jobs. I'm doing that part-time. And the rest of my time, I have a startup. We've built a product called Site44, and it is software as a service that runs in the cloud, but it doesn't run on Windows Azure. So I won't be giving you a bunch of examples from that. But there are technical reasons why we're not on Windows Azure. But I have both. So I have some Windows Azure experience. I have some experience building software as a service, running that in the cloud, figuring that all out, although we've only been at this for a couple months, and so that's a little bit limited. But I thought I'd put those two together and come here and talk to you about generally software as a service on top of Windows Azure. We're going to start by defining what that means. We're going to define software as a service, which is actually it's surprisingly difficult, but we're going to accept the definition that I came up with and move on from there. Then we're going to talk about architecture. And this is actually, I'd say the bulk of the talk is actually in the second bullet, where we're going to be talking about the architecture of software as a service, particularly around tenancy, around single tenant versus multi-tenant, how that works through your whole N-tier architecture and how the different layers work together. And we're going to do demos throughout that and kind of show how to put some of these pieces together. And we're going to wrap up by talking about billing and metering, and a little bit even of me giving some advice about pricing. But we're going to sort of talk about the business side of it. If you're running software as a service, what does that mean in terms of your business model, your relationship with customers? What does that mean in terms of your costs? How do you measure those things and work that out? So let's get started. Let's start by talking about the definition for software as a service. So I looked this up. I went and searched for definitions of software as a service. And they essentially all said anything that uses the internet. If you read through the definition, it meant everything you've ever used that's not sort of pure client-side code that doesn't talk to any service. So software as a service is kind of broad. I'm going to narrow it a little bit. So this is the definition I'd like to use, which as you can see is my definition, said by me right now, which is software delivered over the internet, so I'm not counting sort of client-side code that calls a service or whatever. So software that actually gets delivered primarily over the internet and is billed on a subscription basis. That second part, for some of the things we talk about, doesn't matter, but as we get to the part of the talk where we're talking about billing and pricing and metering, it's going to be sort of important that there's a subscription component to it. So that's the definition. That doesn't mean that any other definition is wrong. It's just the definition I'm going to use for this talk. Okay, so let's dive right in. So that was the first bullet. We knocked off the first bullet of the agenda, which was to define software as a service. Now we're in that second section, which is really about architecture and a lot about multi-tenancy. So I'm going to make the claim that software as a service is commonly multi-tenant, that that's actually really the default, I think, for software as a service. And as I've talked to people about this, we've run into some more definition troubles, which is what exactly does multi-tenant mean? I know the first part, multi means that there's more than one. Tenant is where there's actually a lot of disagreement as you talk to people about, well, what exactly constitutes a tenant? What does that mean? What does that part mean? I'm going to say that that we can define it as a user. And some of you may object. A lot of people, when they think of multi-tenant, think of, well, there's some software that I'm running, and then I have 10 different companies who use it, and each one of those is a tenant. And then they have, I don't know, 1,000 people in their organization or something who are the users. And so tenants aren't necessarily users. I think that's okay. And actually, a lot of things we'll talk about apply to that kind of multi-level sort of thing. But the first level is sort of the tenant. So that might be customers, or that might be accounts, or it might just be users. Okay, so we'll use that sort of definition of multi-tenancy. And with that in mind, then there's a question about the trade-offs of multi-tenancy versus single-tenancy. So now that we sort of have this understanding of what it means, which is basically that resources are shared across multiple users, what are the pros and cons of doing that? So to me, one of the big advantages to using multi-tenancy is that you get very efficient around resource use because you're sharing things. Right? So it's the same reason why we go to virtualization instead of just using individual servers. We get sort of better density. We get better usage out of these things. So if you can serve all of your customers from a single sort of running copy of your software, you get much more efficient use of resources. You also get a lower operational cost in that you're only running one thing, and you sort of have your management view of the application is somewhat simple. The cons are that it's harder to build a service in the multi-tenant way. It's a lot simpler when you have one user, and so there's one database, and there's one set of data, and there's sort of nothing that you have to do around multi-tenancy. So it's more difficult, I'd say, to implement a multi-tenant solution. And there are challenges of isolation. As soon as you do resource sharing, you have a question of, okay, well, how does the use from one user impact the use from another user? And we'll talk about this in a little more detail as we go through, but one thing I'll just sort of raise your awareness of now is there are different kinds of isolation and different kinds of concerns around isolation. The big one that I think jumps to mind immediately is security. People think about, well, if we're all sort of using the same database, how am I sure that that somebody else can't see my data, or these things are sort of intermixed. But don't forget about performance isolation. Depending on the resources that are being shared, it could be that someone doing something very heavy with the application could make the performance suffer for somebody else. And so I would think about security isolation different from performance isolation. There may even be other sort of slices of that. But so multi-tenant gives you this resource efficiency, but you pay for it by having a sort of more difficult implementation, particularly around achieving isolation. Single tenant is naturally kind of the inverse. The pros are it's pretty easy to implement, particularly for migrations. I want to call that out, that if you have software as a service that you're running today, if you have software that you're running today, not as a service, so you're running some software that you ship to a company, they install it on a server, they use it, it's single tenant, and you're looking to migrate that and put that in the cloud, you'll find that single tenant is the easiest thing for you to do because it's a sort of straightforward port of what you already are running. So the move from single tenant to multi-tenant may be tricky. And so one of the pros of single tenant is that if you are migrating something that's already single tenant, that's going to be the easiest path. Another pro is that it has very good isolation just out of the gate. The cons are it's less efficient and there are more things to manage, just sort of the opposite of the multi-tenant pros. Okay, so now let me expand. So we define multi-tenancy basically as sharing resources among tenants, and we could just say that tenants are users, and get a sort of good start to this. Now I kind of want to stretch that definition a little bit and talk about multi-tenancy in a multi-tier app. And so what I believe is that, you know, you in sort of an N-tier app where you have something like client and then services and then data, you can actually make a tenancy choice at each of those tiers. So you can decide, well, the client in the case of software as a service is usually just a web browser. And so that's single tenant in that I'm not letting you use my web browser. I have a web browser. You have a different one, right? But the services that are running somewhere and sort of exposing an interface, those can be single tenant or those can be multi-tenant. It could be that I run one for each user, or it could be that I run one that sort of serves everybody. And the data can be multi-tenant or not also. So there I might have one database that serves all my customers, or I might have several databases, you know, one for each tenant. And I think you can make those decisions somewhat independently. You can actually decide for each of these tiers, what are you going to do? And so I'd encourage you, as you're thinking about your architecture and thinking about multi-tenancy, is to ask the question at sort of all the layers in the architecture. Don't stop at sort of deciding, yeah, we have to do it multi-tenant to save money and sort of get efficiency of resources. You could actually choose to do different things in different places. So we're going to sort of tackle these in a couple ways. We're going to kind of take slices of what you need to do in an app and talk a little bit about what multi-tenancy would look like in those slices. So we'll look at identity, we'll look at sort of the compute part of the app, the running code, and we'll look at data. So an identity, this is one place where I'm going to move and reinstitute the hierarchy of tenants. So I'm going to give sort of back to the view of, well, let's say we have 10 companies who use this, and we refer to them as our tenants. They then have users sort of beyond that. And it's important, particularly in identity, because you often have a lookup problem of if you come to the app and sign in, which tenant are you a part of? And the place that you see this very commonly in software as a service is that the configuration is different for tenants. And sometimes it's even just that they're styled differently, or there's sort of some theming, or there's customization. And so I might get a different view for my company than you get for your company. And so there you have this challenge of kind of how do I assign the users to sort of the right place. And I think that the identity approach is generally one of these two, which is either that you log a user in, and then you look up based on that identity. So I log in and you say, okay, I know this person is Steve Marks. I go look up in my table, Steve Marks, oh, he works at Aditi, so we're going to give him the Aditi view, right? And there's another model, which is that users go directly to one tenant. So in the single tenant case, a user tends to log into aditi.thisawesomesassapp.com, and so they get the Aditi view, and somebody who logs in with a different one gets a different view. And if I don't belong to the Aditi one, when I log in there, it'll fail. And so it's sort of, you've scoped already by the time you got there, the identity is sort of within that scope, versus there's a global identity, and from there you decide kind of what to do with the user. Two technologies in Windows Azure that help with this are Access Control and Active Directory Federation. Access Control just generally is that's the way in Windows Azure to sort of easily log people in and do identity. And Active Directory Federation, in particular for this multi-tenant use where sort of companies have users, it's common that they're using Active Directory within their network and they want to use that identity in the cloud with your SaaS app. And Federated Active Directory is sort of the one of the technologies you can use to use those existing identities in the cloud. So Access Control can sort of directly do that through Active Directory Federation. Okay, let's talk about multi-tenancy. I don't know, let's do the demo early. I was ready for the demo slide to come up, and then I hit the page, and it didn't come to demo, and so I decided we're just going to skip around. So let me show you a demo. So I'm going to introduce the demo that we're going to use for the rest of the talk. There's just sort of this one demo, but we're going to kind of build up little pieces of it and take a look at how things work. And so let's talk about identity right now sort of by itself and talk about how to log people in and how to kind of look up a tenant based on that. So I have this application at smarksfs.azurewebsites. Oh, by the way, I forgot to point out all these slides are at TEE12, techedeurope12.site44.com. So those of you who don't want to actually watch the presentation and instead want to just page through it on your laptop, you can do that. But we have a demo that's at smarksfs.azurewebsites.net. I'm going to open that up. It's a fantastic demo. You log in with Live ID. And so this is identity already working, right? I've logged in with Live ID. It then, this is a best practice, by the way. So notice that I'm asking for your credit card information before I tell you what the service does. And this is a best practice because if I told you what the service does, you probably wouldn't want to pay for it. Right? And so it's good to do it this way. Also note that I'm not telling you how much you're going to be billed, which is, again, because if I told you, it actually bills $100 a month, so you may not want to do that. It's more in euros. No, it's less. It's 69, 70 euros. Okay, so I'm going to submit payment. This is safe to do, by the way. You just leave this default credit card number in, and it just kind of does it. And now that I've paid, some sort of tenant has been provisioned for me. And so now I've got my own sort of space in here. So if you go and do this, you will see a very similar thing. But as soon as we start interacting with this, you'll see you have different data than I have, and we're operating independently. So the functionality of the app is you can upload files, and then after you upload them, you can download them again. This is why I charge you up front before I tell you what it does. So that's actually it. That's all the functionality of this. But you'll note it had some identity, and then we're going to talk about how through the NTR architecture there's sort of multi-tenancy at different layers. And it had sort of payments, and we'll see getting even to sort of some metering and things like that right at the end. So that's the demo app, and I've got sort of a starting point for us loaded up in Visual Studio, and if we run this one, we'll see a similar kind of flow. I have to log in, and after I log in, it says "Hello World" because we haven't actually implemented any of this stuff yet. Bits and pieces of it are there, but we're going to fill in some of sort of the critical parts. So the first thing that I want to do is fill in the identity part. So how did we find out who I am? So I logged in with Live ID. Why did that happen? Why did I get sort of bounced to Live ID? And what do we now know about me? And it's actually pretty simple. I used access control. I'm not going to show you the... I'm not going to sort of step you through setting up access control, because there are a lot of better places to learn about that. But once I got through and I set up an access control namespace and chose that I wanted to use Live ID as the provider, I could have also checked Facebook and Google, and that's part of what access control does that's nice, is let you sort of use all those identity systems together. I chose just Live ID, and then I got from access control a URL that if you visit, asks you to log in with Live ID and then sends you back to my application. And so this is some big horrible URL that I pasted from the Windows Azure portal into my web config. And by putting it in here as authentication forms, if you're not logged in, it bounces you to this site. If you come back, then you get a cookie and then you're sort of logged in. And what happens when you come back is some horrible code I'm a little embarrassed to show you, but I'm going to show you anyway. This. So the right answer is you use Windows Identity Foundation and it just does some magic. Okay, but I wanted to learn how it actually worked, and so I chose the simple web token format for access control. You get back some XML, except you don't. It's like base64 encoded XML, and then you have to pull part of it out, and you have to check a hash. And so all this code that I'm a little embarrassed about is me sort of manually string processing and checking the hash and whatever. But at the end of the day, I get this. I get this hex string, which is a SHA encoded, I believe. I don't remember what I actually did to create this. I think it's a SHA-1 hash of the identity that came back from the provider. So Live ID comes back, gives you some ugly string. It's useless. It's not the Live ID. It's a pairwise unique identifier, which means every time I log into this app, it'll be the same string. But if I log into a different app, it'll be a different string. That's good for privacy because it means that those guys over there can't just forge my signature on something over here. So it's nice. But it's a big, ugly string. It's not very useful. It's bigger than I'm allowed to use for blob storage containers. So for implementation reasons, I shortened it by just doing a hash of that. So that's all this does. So this computes this hash. It does set auth cookie, which is the ASP.NET way to do the forms authentication. So that's why I don't get prompted to log in every time I come back to the page, because it's already, it's stored in the cookie. Okay. All that was sort of an aside. The point is that once we get back here, we can do stuff like user.identity.name, and we're just going to print it out here. And so, I have to build that first. So if we refresh here, now we get, that's my magic pairwise unique identifier, then hashed. And so basically the point of this is if you go and did the same thing, you can't because this is only on my machine. But if you looked at yours, it would be different. Everyone will have a different one than this. So now we have some identity. Let's go back to the slides and we'll talk about what we do with that when we get to sort of the data tier. But we have an identity, and from there we can look up a tenant. So the way we're doing it here is that sort of first option I talked about, which is we're logging somebody in. Once we know who they are, we're looking up a tenant. In this case, the tenant is the user. They're sort of one and the same. And so all we need to know is that string. Skipping back, because we sort of skipped the slide, I want to talk about multi-tenancy and services. I didn't tell you what that was that we were running. In the context of Windows Azure, there are actually a few options for how you run things. These days, and by these days I mean as of like a couple weeks ago, when things changed in Windows Azure, there are really three options for running code in Windows Azure. And those are websites, cloud services, and virtual machines. Websites are the usually shared sort of mode of hosting a web app, ASP.NET or PHP or Node or are those all the options? Sort of IIS-hosted websites. Cloud services are what you've been used to if you've been following Windows Azure for the past few years. That's the web role and the worker role and that kind of model of PaaS on top of sort of VMs, that model. And then virtual machines is the new infrastructure as a service model where you're actually spinning up individual VMs and just the persisted VMs and connecting them. So those are what those are. Each one has options around tenancy. So for websites, you have these two modes. You have the shared mode and dedicated mode. The shared model is very good for single tenant services. This may sound a little strange because the shared model is a multi-tenant, you're using a multi-tenant service. That's where your process is next to somebody else's process on the same machine running behind IIS. It's shared web hosting, essentially, right? And so that shared model is very multi-tenant in terms of the way the service works. But it's good for your single-tenant app because it's a good way for you to deploy without a lot of cost, a lot of different instances of the app. And so if you built one for Aditi and you built one for Microsoft and you built one for another company, you could go deploy all those as separate websites, and the shared model is a really appealing way in terms of resource sharing to make that efficient and not cost a lot. The dedicated model has properties that are pretty similar to cloud services. The dedicated model is where you are deploying individual websites, but you're deploying them to a dedicated resource. So you have some set of VMs that is really just for you, and you're deploying your websites to that. So cloud services have very good isolation boundaries. So cloud services, on the other hand, there's no shared model. There's the you get VMs that are yours, that are running only your app. And so you have this nice kind of isolation boundary. Whether you're doing it, if you, the isolation boundary there is between you and sort of the other apps that are running, whatever. You still have a question of whether you're doing single tenant or multi-tenancy and how do you do the isolation within your app. But your app is nicely isolated. However, because you're spinning up VMs for each of these, if you're tempted to go sort of single tenant, this is not the sort of thing where you want someone to click the button that says, here, I've put in my credit card, and then you're going to spin up a tenant for them, because it's somewhat expensive and it takes a while. I don't mean that it's expensive compared to other ways of doing the same thing, but I mean as compared to sort of spinning up a shared resource like one of these websites. This is something that it's going to spin up brand new VMs that takes a few minutes, and then you're going to pay for them while those machines are running. I mean, there's a sort of separate resource, and that's kind of what you get for that isolation boundary. Virtual machines. Virtual machines are actually cloud services in a pretty fundamental way in the system. And so in terms of the multi-tenancy model and the isolation model and whatever, you'll see that a virtual machine running in Windows Azure looks like a cloud service running in Windows Azure, in that it's a dedicated resource, it's just yours, it's a virtual machine, it takes a while to spin up, you pay for it the entire time that it's running, it's very similar. And so in terms of your tenancy decisions or whatever, virtual machine is kind of a special case of a cloud service. Okay, so we chose, so in the demo we did, I'm using Windows Azure website. So when you go to SmarksFS, in fact, the URL will tell you, that's the way you can cheat and find out, is that if somebody's using the default URL instead of a custom domain name, you'll see AzureWebsites.net means websites, CloudApp.net means cloud services. And so you can kind of see the difference. And so here we're doing websites. So that's how I deployed this app. And we're doing it fully multi-tenant. We're deploying one version of this app, right? There's one URL. Everyone goes to the same URL. And that one web app is serving all the users. So it's multi-tenant in the services tier of our architecture. Okay, so this is what we saw in the demo, the forms auth and sort of setting the cookie. That's all we had to do for that. All right, let's talk about data. I think data is actually probably the most interesting case of sort of where people make hard decisions about multi-tenancy and really struggle to decide the right thing. There are a lot of reasons to make different decisions here, and so I think it's kind of a meaty topic. So one thing you could do, so by the way, we're going to talk about data first from Windows Azure Storage, and then we're going to talk about from SQL, Windows Azure Database. We're going to look at kind of the Windows Azure SQL Database. Is that the branding now? We're going to look at kind of those two slices. So let me start by talking about Windows Azure Storage. Windows Azure Storage means like blobs and tables. That's the sort of NoSQL scale out kind of option in Windows Azure. So let's talk about that first. There are, I think on this slide, there are about to be three different options for this. One is doing one account per tenant. So this is where we're going to actually have a new storage account for each user of the app or each tenant of the app. This is good in terms of isolation because you've actually, it's a wholly different account, particularly in terms of security isolation. It has a different key set. And so if just because I know how to get into that account does not mean that I know how to get into anybody else's account. So very good security isolation in that sense. It also has good performance isolation. There are actually some scalability targets. That's actually the magic phrase. If you're looking for these things, search for like Windows Azure Storage scalability targets, and you'll get exactly the numbers of sort of what you're supposed to be able to do with these different things. And so accounts actually have a cap. You can do something like 5,000 operations per second against a single account. And so if you really want the best security isolation, the best performance isolation, you run many accounts, right? And each account sort of gets that, and they're completely isolated from each other. That said, Microsoft won't let you run very many of these. There's a limit to how many of these you can get per subscription. And so if you're signed up for Windows Azure, I think by default you'll only be able to create 5 storage accounts. And if you call Microsoft, they'll probably let you create 20. And then if that's not enough and you call Microsoft and you beg, I think sometimes they'll let you go a little bit higher, but pretty much they'll say no. And so you're certainly not going an order of magnitude different from that or whatever. The number's about 20 that they'll let you do. And so the design of the system is not for people to create many, many accounts, for you to create a million accounts because you have a million users. That's not what you're going to end up doing. And so this is kind of just a limitation. So you might like to do this. You might like the isolation you can get from this. You're probably not going to be able to do it for a lot of different users. So one step down from that in the hierarchy, so you have accounts and then you have partitions. In Windows Azure Storage, there's sort of, in table storage it's called partitions, in blob storage it's actually the blob itself, in queues it's the queue. But in all of them they have sort of a something below the level of accounts where there is actually some isolation in terms of performance. The scalability targets you all find are sort of per partition. There's one for sort of the account. There's this 5,000 per second for the account. And then for each partition, you can get 500 per second. And those are kind of isolated from each other. So again, you have another place to isolate. they're not isolated in terms of security. Different partitions all use the same set of keys, and so they're all kind of part of the same account. But they do have a little isolation in terms of performance. So doing one partition per tenant, it's usually really easy to implement because your partition key, the thing that separates the partitions, is the tenant ID or the username if users are your tenants. In fact, that's what we're going to do. I'll tell you now when we get to the demo and kind of do the blob storage sort of partitioning, we're going to use container names that are just the username. And that's how we're going to do it. So it's typically very easy to do. There's pretty good performance isolation because the performance per partition is kind of separate. Those targets, it's 500 per second of some kind of operation separated sort of in different partitions. That said, there is still the account level kind of 5,000 per second. They're limited in terms of the security isolation and management isolation. That's something also to think about is that if you have an account per tenant, it's easy to delete a tenant because you delete the account. Once you have a partition per tenant, you're in this, well, am I sure I deleted everything that had that partition key? It's not as natural of a way to manage these things. It's hard to look at all of them. And so in terms of management, you kind of lose a little bit of that. Okay, and then finally, you can have no isolation. Which is you put everything together. I don't want this to sound bad. I don't know of a way to say that without it sounding like, well, that's no good because isolation is good and whatever. This isn't necessarily wrong. It's one of the options. And no isolation may really mean, and usually does mean, that we've externalized the isolation. So instead of it being in the storage system that there's this user and there's this user, maybe somewhere over in the database you have which user has access to which file. You have, you know, ACLs or something. And so your app is usually isolating people in some way, but you're not doing it at sort of the data layer itself. You're doing it sort of up from there. So that's also a viable option. You could argue, actually, that the scheme I'm going to show you is more no isolation than it is partition level isolation. I'll try to remember to explain what I mean by that when we get to that. But let's talk about SQL first. So SQL has a similar kind of thing. You can have a database per tenant, which gives you pretty good performance isolation. It can be expensive. You pay sort of by the database and by the size of the database, and so it depends sort of how big these things are. It may work out that it's about the same, but often it means you're paying for sort of more database than you really need for each of these tenants. So it can add up, but it's good in terms of isolation. You can have a table per tenant, which sounds a little unnatural, I think, to most people designing databases, to have a different table for tenant A. So you have something like, you know, photos underscore Aditi and photos underscore Microsoft as different tables. It's weird. People usually put a table and sort of put that as part of the key. So it's a little bit strange, and that's why I mentioned it's a bit awkward to implement. Most of the tools you'll find aren't really helpful with this. You know, any framework probably doesn't help you to do this. But it helps in terms of security isolation of queries. Like, you've immediately scoped, by picking a table name, you've immediately scoped the query. You're unlikely to return the wrong customer's rows. And so it's got this kind of nice property. And so I've seen some people do it, but I think it's an uncommon choice. And finally, you can shard, right? This is what you can always do in SQL, is you can shard. This we may have labeled as the as maybe external isolation or something. This is the, we're going to do horizontal partitioning, another way to say sharding, but we're going to use the federation capabilities that are kind of built into Windows Azure. Which means you sort of, every query has to specify a key, like a tenant ID we would use, right, for our example. And then it scopes that to the right database. So you've got 10 databases serving your site, and every query is going to go to one of those 10 based on sort of ranges. So that's kind of nice. It gives you a little bit of help on the security isolation. It gives you nice scalability because you get to sort of decide how many of these databases you're going to have. And it gets you some performance isolation. The problem with the federation stuff is that you still have a lot of tenants on the same database. It's just you don't have all of them. So you've got 10 of these databases instead of one, and you're scoped to the right one out of those 10. But then beyond that, it's just a query sort of across a big table. And so again, in terms of performance isolation, it helps a little bit, but you're still putting some people together. So those are kind of the big options, I think, in data multi-tenancy. All right, so let's do a demo. Let's go back to our app and do multi-tenant blob storage. So a little more typing for this one. We're going to do, let's just do this. Return view. Ignore for a moment my empty string array, because we'll come back to that. That should eventually be a list of blobs that I've already uploaded. But for now, we're just going to never have anything there. Okay. So now we have, so I've already built the UI. So there's some view somewhere that presents this thing. But we're going to implement the upload. So right now, if I go and upload a picture, it's going to say not implemented yet because we haven't implemented it. And so what we want to do is do something with the upload here. And what we're going to do is actually pretty simple. We're going to get a container reference that is the user's identity, right? So that string that we were putting out, that's going to be the container that we use. And that's how we're doing our isolation, right? So this is the tenancy thing. We've looked up a user. We've just found a container that belongs to that user. And we're going to use it from then on. We're going to create it if it's not already there. And then we're going to upload. So we're going to grab a blob reference, and we're going to use the name of the file that we got. So this is just sort of the ASP.NET MVC way to get at the file. So we're going to use the file name. We're going to set the content type correctly, just to match. And then we're going to upload it. And when we're all done, we're going to just send them back to the index. Okay, so, whoops. So let's do that, see if it works. Sure, we'll re-upload the file we were already uploading. Hopefully we get no errors here. Hey, wait, why didn't we get redirected? Let me try that again. There we go. Okay. So we have to take it on faith for the moment that the upload actually worked, because we don't see anything. Remember, our view sort of isn't populated yet. We can actually check. Let's not take it on faith. This one's me. I've memorized the number. There's the file that we've... I've done this enough times. There's the file that we uploaded. Okay. So our upload works. Let's pause for just a second and think about why it works and why this is good. What we've done is we made a container per user, so I have a different container than you have and than you have. And when I upload, my uploads always go into that container. So we've gotten our isolation in that the first thing we do is we scope to a container, and we scope to the container based on the user's identity. And so we have very little risk of kind of showing somebody the wrong photos, whatever. As long as we got the identity right, we can go in and sort of give them their own space. Now I'll explain what I meant by we're sort of doing the everything's intermixed, no isolation kind of model, because in terms of blob storage, the partition is actually the blob itself. So the container doesn't actually do anything in terms of performance isolation, and it doesn't do anything in terms of security isolation by itself, because there's no, it's the same key as for the rest of the account. So we've actually kind of just created a bunch of blobs. It's just we've happened to prefix them all with the username. Right, and so it's kind of logic in our app that is doing the partitioning in this, and this happens a lot as you sort of design these multi-tenant systems. It's a question of kind of what's the contract you have with the data system or with the service or something like that. And so here the contract we have is everything's going to be in the same container for a given user, and they're never going to go outside of that container. Okay, so so let's fill this thing out. And the reason I actually want to do this is that I want to show you guys kind of a trick. So let's get the container again. It should already exist. Let's go crazy and create it a bunch of times. Really good for the performance of our app. just ignore that. So now what we want to do is we want to list everything that's in that. Well, we want to list all the files that belong to me as a user. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to go straight to the container for me, and then we're going to list everything inside of that. And what I want to show you here is that I'm actually using something called shared access signatures. How many people know what a shared access signature is in Windows Azure? It's like oddly this 2/3 of the room and not that 1/3 of the room. But For those who don't know, shared access signatures are basically a way to give someone a pre-authorized URL. So instead of having to sign the headers and know the secret key when you call the API, you can do that ahead of time and then give somebody a special URL that's already authorized so that they can read the file or actually write or delete. You can give them all sorts of permissions. And so the reason I wanted to kind of show you this little bit of code is that it's pretty easy to generate those, and that's what we're going to do. So that list that we saw, if you go to smorksfs.azurewebsites.net and do this yourself, that list is all directly to blob storage, but they have these really funny URLs that are these shared access signatures. Okay, so we're going to just list the blobs. We're going to get the ones that are cloud blobs for reasons of poor API design, if you ask me. And then we're going to select from there for each blob. We're going to take the URL for the blob, and we're going to add to it a shared access signature, because a shared access signature is a query string that goes on the end of the URL. So we're going to take the base URI, and then we're going to add to it a shared access signature. And Why can't I get IntelliSense? I don't know how to do this without IntelliSense. New shared access policy. It means that I got something wrong in here, right? And in here we're going to specify the permissions, and we're going to just give read access, and then we're going to specify an expiration time. Sorry, we should start with now. This is the way that you kind of scope these things down. So I'm going to make these only good for 5 minutes. So if you sit on this page and don't click anything for 5 minutes and then start clicking things, they won't work. It's actually that URL is going to have encoded in it sort of when it expires. Okay, and now we're going to find out what I did wrong. What did I do wrong? Does anybody see what's... Oh, I don't want that. Right? Is that going to do it? No. Wait, now I did it. It's just one missing paren. Okay. So now in theory, we should see the chrysanthemum picture that we uploaded. And the URL for this is something awful. If we expand it out, it may be a little too small to see. But it says chrysanthemum.jpg ?SE equals, and then that's the expiration time. SR equals B, which means blob. SP equals R means read permissions. It's all the stuff that we did encoded in here. And at the end of it is a signature. And that's the secret of sort of how the authentication works. That says somebody who does know the key, who actually owns that blob, has given you this access because it's signed by that entity. So anyway, so just that's kind of a little separate from the point of this talk, but a little aside on shared access signatures. They're actually really easy to do, and they're kind of nice for this kind of thing where you want to give somebody access to a file for a period of time. So now the whole thing should be working. We should be able to upload something else and get it up there. Notice how this one is no longer visited because it's a different URL now because it's got a different expiration time and so a different signature. Okay. So we basically just did multi-tenancy and blob storage by doing different containers per user. So I could have just cheated. I could have copied it from here. It's right in the slides. All right, let's move on. Okay, so we've covered as much as we're going to anyway about sort of multi-tenant architecture. I'd like to talk a little bit about business models. And billing and metering. I think these come up a lot as people think about building new software as a service. These are the questions that they're asking. So here's my general strategy. This is my advice to you for business models. Figure out what your costs are, figure out how much customers will pay, and then charge something that's in between those two numbers. This may be obvious. I mean, the reason you laugh is because, well, of course. I don't want to say this in too negative a way, but you'd be surprised how many people I talk to who are not doing this, who are doing something different from this. And these mistakes are made in two different ways. Probably the most common is they've never figured out how much a customer will actually pay for something. And so they're just basing this on their cost, and they go, well, we're going to add 10% to what it costs us. And then they find out there is no market for that. Whatever. So that's common. But it's actually also very common for people to not think about their costs and to go straight from, hey, we found out customers will pay $50 a month for this. Great. And they haven't worked through how the use of the app is going to affect their costs. And particularly in the cloud, this is going to be in your face a lot, because you're going to be billed based on what your usage is. And so your costs are probably going to be variable, and they're going to be based on how users are using the app. And so it's actually very easy to forget about figuring out the costs. And the other, there's a sort of third mistake that people make around this, which is not focusing on the fact that all they have to do is charge somewhere in between these numbers. So they either think that they've got to map it exactly to their cost. So if this user used the app twice as much this month, we're going to charge them twice as much. They sort of try to fit those things together. And they get too tied to the cost model when they should be thinking about their pricing model. And those might be totally separate. So the example I like to give, which may work terribly in Europe, is Netflix. Which is right, because Netflix is, but there's another one, right? There's a very similar service around here. But if you know Netflix, right, it's a model of sort of, particularly I'm thinking about their streaming service. So it's a model of paying a subscription, so you pay every month, and then you get to watch movies online. And I'm confident, looking at their prices, that some users probably lose them money by viewing a bunch of streams, right? And most probably view next to nothing and charge and pay a lot of money, and they make a lot of profit. And in aggregate, I'm very confident that they're profitable. They're making money on this. But what they did is they didn't go look at their cost model and then turn it into a pricing model. Which is great, because I would hate it if every time I clicked to play a movie, I knew it was going to cost me a little extra. That's why everyone hates micropayments. They're stressful. In my 4 years of working on Windows Azure, one of the biggest lessons I learned is that everyone hates utility billing. It's the way Windows Azure is built. It's the way most cloud things are built, or at least most infrastructure-y cloud things are built. There are good reasons for that. You actually need it so that you can keep the cost really low. That's part of the efficiency, is that you're only getting charged for what you're using, and if you got charged more at a flat rate, it wouldn't be cost effective and it wouldn't save you the money. So it's good. I'm not saying it's bad that it's done, but everybody hates it. Everyone's uncomfortable with it. It's hard to budget. So if you're building software as a service, don't charge users based on use if you can avoid that. Charge them a flat rate that's predictable. And in fact, I have a few examples of kind of how people do that. But that's what I would suggest. And the way that you know that's okay is because you've understood the costs, and then you've understood what people are going to pay, and you've priced sort of in between. So a few popular approaches. One is tiered pricing plans. For example, freemium, you may have a tier where it costs you nothing per month, and then you may have a tier that's $20 per month, and et cetera. Or there's sort of the standard and pro or something. That's very common. And it's a way to get around this, well, the users who use it a lot actually cost me a lot more. Figuring out one price may be really hard, and that way you can figure out multiple prices and people can kind of fit themselves in there. I'm just going to have one tier. It's a flat rate, typically accompanied by, or sometimes accompanied by, some sort of cap. We'll only let you watch so many hours of streaming video, so that there aren't those abuse cases that kind of go over and end up costing you money. And then there's utility billing, which, as I said, everybody should try to avoid if you can. So who runs the service is an interesting question that comes around that's sort of kind of related to business model, related to kind of implementation. But if you're running the single tenant model, you have these two options. And one is that you can run the service and bill your customer. The other one is that you can actually either in some fashion have the customer themselves, your customer, running the app and being sort of responsible for that. And it's one way that sometimes people do this sort of utility version, is they give the app over to somebody else to run, and they have to pay the bill. So you pay me something for sort of the fact that I built the software, and then you pay for your usage. And so if you use a lot of bandwidth, you just pay that. And one easy way to do that is if I just give you the app and you run it yourself. So some people do this. And sometimes we're in a relationship where I'll give you the app to run, but you'll give me access to your subscription in Windows Azure or something, so I can still manage it and upgrade it for you and do that. But you're the owner of it. You're the guy who pays the bill. You decide. Again, people prefer the former more than the latter. They like it if somebody else just runs it for them and they don't have to worry about it. But if you do get to this thing where you're sort of in that utility model or your costs and your pricing are very closely related, it may be nice to just pass it directly on by having the customer run the service themselves. So there are lots of ways to bill people for things. I'm going to broadly group things into you're either part of some sort of store, some sort of marketplace, or you're just billing. Right, so it's you've got the customer, you acquire the customer, you charge them some amount, and then you give them access. And the difference is that the store or the marketplace gives you discoverability in addition to just the billing part of it, the mechanics of billing somebody. So the popular example is these phone marketplaces, right? If you have an iPhone or an Android phone or a Windows phone, you go buy the app from some store, all the apps are there. You search in there to find the app. That's how you found out about the app in the first place. That's how you bought it. Windows Azure actually has a marketplace themselves. And so you can kind of get listed in the Windows Azure marketplace, and people can search through there and find you that way, and then they can pay, and then they sort of get sent back to you. It's actually really nice because you don't have to do anything. You basically get an API call when somebody has paid. So when I go and sign up for the XYZ plan, you get an API call that says, hey, this guy just signed up for the XYZ plan. I come to the site, log in, and then you just mark in the row that, you know, forevermore my login is associated with that plan. And so it's very nice. You've kind of outsourced that whole problem to it. You've gotten the discoverability. You pay for that in that Microsoft takes a 20% cut for the marketplace. Now I don't remember for sure, but I think it's 20%. And so there's sort of, you know, part of that money goes to Microsoft for doing that. So that's one of the options. I think the other option, sort of broadly, is you're using a payment processor, which is, well, somebody came to my site because I advertised and I acquired the customer, but now they want to type in a credit card and then get something. I outsource the credit card part to somebody else. PayPal is probably the biggest of these. Stripe is probably the newest and coolest. Recurly, there are actually a bunch of these, and they're just handling billing. Like, I hand them a customer who's ready to go. I tell PayPal how much to charge them, and you know, and how often to do it. And in the case, some of these do sort of recurring payments and things like that. And so it's a different kind of, they come in a little bit later in the process. So there's no discoverability. I don't go to PayPal and search for an app. It's after that I kind of go there. Things to consider are how easy is it to integrate these different things, discoverability that you get from a marketplace, do you need that? Is it worth kind of what you pay to kind of get into one of those marketplaces? Sometimes you have no choice. Sometimes you're in one of these closed systems like the phone systems where you have to be part of the app to sort of play in that space. And then customer UI. Depending on kind of which of these you choose, you're either responsible for a lot of that, showing them their bill, letting them cancel something, whatever. Or you've kind of handed it off, and it really depends. If you use the Windows Azure Marketplace, it's, again, you get an API call if somebody cancels, and you just have to delete their row in the table, and you're done. But if you go sort of lower down, and you're really just processing credit card statements or credit card numbers and payments, you have to be able to give people statements, let them dispute a charge or whatever, and you need to provide UI for users to do that. And so there's a question of how much of that are you responsible for. Okay, so let's do a little demo where we charge our users. So I'm going to come back to our website here. And actually, I'm going to delete myself from Blob Storage. And we're going to change this a little bit. We're going to say if the container doesn't already exist, then we'll return a different view called pay me for obvious reasons, I guess. So now if I load this, because I deleted the container, we should hit that path where now it shows you this view, which we've already seen is the we won't tell you what it's going to cost or what you're going to get, but please type in your credit card number and go. And this is I can show you this just because it's interesting. If you haven't used Stripe, it's a kind of neat it's a nice way that they do the API, which is basically you call from you write a little JavaScript that sends that credit card number and all that data to Stripe. And so it never comes to your service. So if you're worried about sort of the compliance issues and how do I store credit cards, that's what Stripe's doing for you, is you send the credit card to Stripe. They send you back a magic token. And the token represents the row in their database where they have the actual credit card number and those kind of details. And you can use that token to then bill. So all that you have in your system is some opaque string that you can't derive anything from, but you can use it to tell Stripe what should happen. And by having an API key, no one else can use that token. So even if somebody gets this, they can't do anything with it. So that's it. So this call is actually where we're sort of sending things off to Stripe and getting the token. When we get the token back, we stick it into the form. We're just adding it as a member of that form, and then we submit the form. And the form itself actually doesn't submit the credit card number and whatever. Those are sort of not part of that the form submit. How does that happen? There's some code here that does that, I think. So that's it. Then we come back to this. So we post this to a URL action called pay. And so if we come back in here, I've already written that one. This is the pay thing. This just calls the Stripe API, uses that token, and says create a user in my default payment plan, which is the $100 a month that it costs to use this awesome service. And what comes back from that is a customer ID, and we're just sort of keeping that as metadata so that later we could bill for something else, or if they canceled, we'd know which container it was, you know, just to kind of keep that relationship together. And then at the bottom of this, you'll see we're actually creating the container. So if the container doesn't exist, we send them to the payment thing, then they create the container. And that's kind of it. So we don't need this anymore because no one can upload unless they've already gotten a container and done that. Okay. So that was really simple sort of billing with Stripe. If you're using one of these other things, it's a similar kind of concept, but the code will be perhaps quite different. Okay. So if you're going to bill, so let's talk about understanding the costs and how those relate to users and how they're using the system. And remember, I'm very much against passing those costs directly on. But you do need to understand them, and sometimes you have to limit them. Remember we talked about, you know, having a flat rate but putting some sort of usage cap. So what we're ultimately going to do in this app that we've been, in this demo that we've kind of been doing, we're going to limit the amount of storage space that someone can use. So they can't just upload a lot of stuff. We're going to limit it. In fact, we're going to limit it to 1 megabyte because anything bigger is hard to demo because you have to upload a lot of files. So we're going to limit and just say users can only get 1 megabyte. They're only paying me $100 a month. That's all I can afford. I mean, 1 megabyte of storage and blob storage costs is a penny or so. I mean, it's sort of it's a very small number. Anyway, but that's all we're going to give people for their money. But in general, you have this question of there are lots of things you might measure. It depends on how the usage of the app affects the cost. What are you going to measure? How are you going to measure it? What are you going to do with that? So let's talk about things that you can measure. And more often, we're going to talk about things you shouldn't measure. One thing I want to warn you away from is measuring CPU usage. Yes, it's true that if someone clicks a button a lot of times, your CPU will spike and you'll need more servers and so it'll cost you more. I mean, there's a relationship there. But it's very hard to get accurate information about, well, this guy browsing at this time cost me this much in terms of CPU usage. In particular, if people are doing things at the same time, it's hard to figure out if they had done them separately. It may have taken more time than it took to do them together and things like that. It's a very tricky thing. I've seen people try to do this. I think it's never worked. So don't try to count CPU cycles kind of at that level. That being said, you can count CPU in terms of, and that might be my next bullet. Oh, yeah. Look how good I was when I designed these slides. You can count CPU usage in terms of VM hours. So if you're running the sort of, I don't know, financial predictions kind of thing or something. Someone might submit a job and you spin up 100 VMs for 3 hours to compute the result and then you spin them down. Counting that makes total sense to me. That's the big driver of your costs. That's the way that you'll understand how much that user is costing you. And that'll help you figure out what your costs are, which is part of the three-step process of figuring out what to bill people and how to design your pricing. So it is okay to count VM hours. If you're doing this sort of thing where you're spinning up VMs, you know, sort of custom based on actions. You might count bandwidth. It depends what you're doing. I think this is, again, we're on sort of the, it depends what the drivers are, right? You want to look at what is it that's expensive and what's driving my costs? What per user sort of thing is costing me money? And bandwidth might be it. Actually, for the app we're designing here, I might limit people to 1 megabyte of storage space, but if they download that, if they download those files every second, eventually my bandwidth charges are going to be really high and I'm going to be losing a lot of money. So do think about counting bandwidth. In my startup, this is our thing. We do sort of static web hosting kind of stuff. And so bandwidth is actually like the charge for us. And so we actually do measure bandwidth sort of really accurately. And so it is something that you can measure if that is a driver for the business you're in. You might count data size. As I said, we're going to do that. If people are uploading files, you might count that. Often, this isn't the driver. I mean, look at the money. You know, come up with a range. Go, well, what is the biggest user going to possibly store in here? And figure out what that's going to cost you per month. And then decide, oh, actually, everything else is costing me more. The example I always give people is that in blob storage, it costs the same amount of money to upload a gigabyte file as it does to store that file for a month. And so the bandwidth is more likely to be the driver. You know, the uploads and downloads are more likely to be the driver than the actual size. And so what we're about to do with the SmarksFS demo is probably wrong. Measuring that data size is probably no good. But it's a good proxy. So while bandwidth may be your driver, it could be that, well, look, if no one can upload a file bigger than 10 megabytes, there's no way they're streaming DVDs, and so I don't have to worry about some of those scary cases of bandwidth. And people respond much better to the limit on data size than they do anything else. Dropbox is a good example of a service that where their costs are almost certainly related to bandwidth, but the way they bill and the way they do their usage tiers is based on data size. And I think they've done a similar thing, which is that, look, if you don't give people a lot of space, there are certain things they can't do with the service, and they won't eat up all that bandwidth. Okay, so how do you measure these things? There are a few ways. Here I want to talk about some Windows Azure technologies that help you to measure certain things. So logging is the best way to measure a lot of things, particularly things that are custom to your app. If you need to know when somebody does something or how many times they do something, you're going to have to log that. There's a diagnostics capability built into Windows Azure. You don't have to use it. You can roll your own. I sort of famously use a log writer that I wrote myself that just appends to a table, and it does it synchronously so I can just watch it in real time. Whatever. So I do that, but there's the diagnostic system built in, and that stuff is kind of getting better, so you can think about using that. If you're using Windows Azure Storage, there are some analytics and logging things built in that let you do things like log every time somebody accesses a blob, and then by reading through that log, you can figure out roughly what bandwidth was used. I say roughly because someone may access a blob and then just kill the download immediately or something. But it gives you at least an upper bound on what could they have done. You can also measure capacity. So blob storage will sort of write once an hour or something like that. They'll write the total amount of space used per storage account. And so I'm pointing out that it's per storage account because, remember, you can't have a lot of accounts, so you're not going to have an account per user. So if you're trying to get sort of per user usage, you're not going to be able to use this for that. But it's good at sort of the account level and good for sort of monitoring those costs and making sure something isn't going wrong or you don't have someone kind of abusing the system. So you can use those. If you're using Windows Azure Storage, there's some built-in capabilities for that. You can always go to the billing data. That's where you'll get your usage of the system entirely. I say it's a last resort, largely because it's not immediate, it's delayed, and it's not very easy to consume. There's no API where you get to just go query the system and say how many bandwidth, you know, how many bytes have I transferred this month, or how many CPU hours have I consumed. You end up with, you've got a big Excel spreadsheet, basically, a comma-separated list. And so you have to parse that all out and figure it out. So it's not very easy to consume, and it's often delayed by, I think, up to a day. A lot of that data is like a day behind. Okay, so let's roll our own metering. So we have determined that we can't use any of these. I'll tell you why. So we're going to limit people to, they only get 1 megabyte of data storage per account. So each user only gets 1 megabyte. Windows Azure Storage could tell us how much we were using total for the account, but it can't tell us how much each container is using. The billing data, again, like nothing is sort of at the container level. So there's nothing built into the system that's going to tell us this. So we're going to build our own. This one we're not going to type a lot of code for. This one I've sort of got pretty much done already, and we're going to kind of jump to the answer. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to make one little change here. So after I've uploaded a file, I'm going to get a queue called meter, and I'm going to add a message. What are we going to put in here? We're going to put the name of the container, which happens to be the name of the user, because that's how we set it up. And so basically, I'm giving a signal, I'm putting a message on a queue that says, hey, we just uploaded something. Double check if we're over our limit. That's basically what this means, is it's time to look at this container and figure out if this user has gone over their limit. We'll come back. We're going to make one more change in that file, but we'll come back to it. Here's where the work is going to happen, and here, like I said, I've sort of written this code out already. This is a worker role that is going to run completely separate from, so we're going to have this Windows Azure website, it's going to write to a queue, then somewhere else we've got a worker role running continuously that's going to pull off the queue and do some work. And what it's going to do is it's going to compute the total amount of data in the container, so that the amount of that user's data. It's going to compare it to our magic number of, you'll have to trust me that I got the zeros right, but that's 1 megabyte of data. And if it's over that limit, we're going to set some metadata on the container to say disabled equals true. So we're just going to set the, and we're just saying this user is over the limit. Now normally you'd have, you'd have to figure out, well, how does the user then delete some, well, we don't have delete at all in this. You can upload things, but you can't delete them. So you're going to go over your 1 megabyte. Normally you'd send an email to the user and you'd say, hey, you have to clean up your stuff. Or maybe this is the, well, you're allowed to use, if we weren't using sort of size of data, but if we're using something like bandwidth, we'd say, well, next month you're reset. Like you're over for this month, we're going to cut off the system, but next month it's going to reset again and you're going to be back at zero. So normally there'd be sort of another step here. Here we're just going to permanently ban the user. We're going to keep charging them, by the way. Nothing here. Stop. So every month they're going to pay, but they can't use the system anymore. So I'm going to make a lot of money from this service. So that's it. So this is pretty standard, pull a message off the queue. This is sort of a safety check, which is like if we've seen this message 3 times already and we seem to crash every time we see this message, we're just going to delete it and skip it. This is pretty safe to do in this kind of system because, well, the next time they upload, we're going to check again. And so, you know, it's kind of okay to ignore these things. Sometimes you want to store it somewhere else, but this is the poison message problem is what this is that you've got a message on the queue where every time you process it, it crashes your system. Make sure you get that off the queue eventually. And this is a nice way to do it is just check how many times have I read this message already. So we'll do it up to 3 times. We'll get the container. This is an ugly link query that just gets the length and sums everything up. So this just sort of gets, for that container, the total usage. Compares it to our megabyte and then disables the account by setting some metadata on the container. So we do actually have to go back here and say, if the container metadata, if we're disabled, sorry, no service for you. We'll just return a little friendly user message. Let's rebuild that. Let's start our worker role. So I'm going to run this also. So deployed, I have the website deployed. I don't have the worker role deployed anywhere. I could just run it on my laptop, but normally I'd create a cloud service here and sort of upload that and run it. But we're just going to run it here. And now, if we go back to the app, Let's see, we haven't paid yet, so we'll pay. That'll create the container. We'll upload chrysanthemums. That's okay. That's only, I checked, it's like 800 kilobytes. By the time we upload desert, that'll work fine, because remember, we only check afterwards, right? So we upload the file, then we check. But the next one I do should probably fail. So I'm going to upload another one, and it says, sorry, no service for you, because we've set the metadata to say disabled. So that's it. So just a simple demo of kind of if you need to enforce caps, this is one way you can do it. Do it offline. Do it asynchronously. That way it doesn't interfere with the performance of your app. But once a day or once every time somebody does a certain action or whatever, double check, see what they're doing, and disable them after the fact. You can also do it up front. I could have logic in the upload method that computed the sum, added the size of the file you were trying to upload, and determine if that was over, and then shut it down sort of there. But then I'd have to do that computation every time you uploaded a file, and you know there's a penalty to kind of doing those things up front. And so I think it's a nice pattern to kind of do these after the fact. Remember that if you've gotten your costs and how much people will pay, and you've priced somewhere in the middle, you may be fine with people going a little over your cap, right? There may be enough room for that. And so don't get sort of paranoid about that. If you have a few users who got a few extra megabytes because you didn't check, that's probably not going to affect the profitability of your app, you know. Okay, so this slide is red because this is the shameless self-promotion part. I'm going to talk a little bit about, and this is it. This is the last slide before we sort of wrap up. But I thought I'd share with you, Site44, which is my startup, is not built on Windows Azure, but it uses a very similar kind of multi-tier architecture, and it's fully multi-tenant sort of throughout the thing. And so I thought I'd kind of give you the story of kind of our architecture and our business model and sort of where we fit in there. So we have I already told you the basic functionalities. We're doing like static web hosting. There's Dropbox in the back of this picture, but it doesn't really matter for what we're talking about. Basically, we have some data. We serve it up, and we have caching in between, and that's kind of our whole system. And so we have this caching tier. It's scaled out, and it's multi-tenant, so sort of everything that gets sent through there is just kind of cached as sort of an output cache thing. We have a web server that sits behind that, and again, it's fully multi-tenant, and it's scaled out. Now, this is by the third bullet, you can figure out where this is hosted. We do have a structured database that's in the back end but is scaled out. And that's kind of where some of the, that and sort of the next layer are where the actual tenancy of the system comes in. So within the database, we know that this URL is part of this data set. It's this user's data. And so we know where to fetch it and where to pull it in. And then we have an in-memory sort of database and cache. We use Redis, which is a fantastic product, by the way. Redis is like, for those who don't know, it's an in-memory database. It's kind of like Memcached, but with awesome data structures. So you can have like sets and lists and hashes, and you can do set operations and sort things and whatever. So it's kind of it's all in-memory, and it's often used as a cache. But in our case, and in a lot of cases, you can use it as a full-blown database because it's got a lot of capabilities. And so we have sort of another layer where that's replicated, not scaled out. That's actually full replication of these things, and is again where some of the tenancy lies. So that's the place where then you do a query. It's per user, or it's per website in our case, but you know it sort of grabs you to the right place. And we're doing freemium with capped usage, so very similar to what we built in this kind of demo. Is we do that, but think of that as a special case of a tiered usage kind of thing. You charge some people less money, some people more money, broadly based on some meter, in our case bandwidth, and then you shut them down when they go over their limits. And that's kind of what we do. Okay, so let's wrap up. My advice is decide about per tier tenancy. So remember to always think in terms of those tiers. You may do multi-tenant in one tier, but single tenant in another tier. That's okay. That's actually pretty normal. So think about that per tier. Consider the costs. So resource efficiency, you get more efficiency if you share things. Consider the isolation requirements. The less you share things, the more you've got security and performance isolation. decide on your business model. Again, figuring out your costs, figuring out how your customers would like to pay, what they'd be willing to pay. And also think about what you can measure. Some people come up with a fantastic business plan, but it's based on something they can't actually figure out, like CPU cycles. Some people come up with it and they go, well, look, we don't know how many servers we're going to need, but it's somehow based on how people use the app. And we're going to figure out how each person is contributing to that total, and we're going to bill them. And then it ends up that they can't actually meter the thing that they wanted to. So make sure you're thinking about the reality of what you can measure and what's easy to measure. And, of course, use Windows Azure where you can. Well, I mean, the talk is about Windows Azure. All right. And then... we're just at the end of the time, so I don't think we can do a lot of Q&A here, but I'll stick around in the room, and so if you want to hang back and ask a couple questions, you can definitely do that. Otherwise, I'll be at the Windows Azure booth like all day tomorrow, so you can always find me. And if you need to find me anywhere else, just remember Smarks, and you can kind of get to all those URLs. Great. Okay. Thanks a lot.